All right. Well, again, good morning. I'd like to call to order this informational hearing of the House Health and Human Services Finance Division. Welcome, everybody. So just a reminder to have everyone mute your feed and then raise your hand if you would like to speak. And we're going to, staff will be watching for that, and hopefully we'll call on you in order in which you have raised your hands. So we are here today to hear from the Department of Human Services about our Direct Care and Treatment Division. So some of you may know that we've had some budget issues. It's no secret that the entire state budget is heading into deficit, and we're going to be dealing with some really difficult financial situations for quite some time. But in direct care and treatment, we have a budget deficit for this year, and the commissioner's been working to try to figure out how to resolve that budget deficit for this budget year, and then we have, of course, a budget deficit going into the next biennium, which we'll be wrestling with as well. So the commissioner recently has announced that there are going to be certain reductions that are planned for this year to try to deal with the looming budget deficit. And I thought it would be a good idea to have a hearing today to try to give members and the public an opportunity to try to understand a little more about what this division does, what direct care and treatment does, because I think it's, even though it's a large division of DHS, it employs a lot of people, it employs the far, you know, far beyond the majority of the people in that are employees of DHS are employed in direct care and treatment. And it's very important. It serves a lot of people. I think it's somewhat of a well-kept secret that a lot of us don't understand a lot about what it does. And so I thought it would be a good idea to have a presentation to sort of explain what the division is, what it does, and then talk about the budget deficit and talk about the commissioner's plans for dealing with it and what the concerns are, what the options are, because even with what the commissioner has proposed or has put forward to deal with this immediately, it doesn't even take care of the whole budget deficit for this year, for this budget year. So there are some very difficult choices ahead. And so this is an opportunity to have a window into those choices. I think what we should do, the commissioner is going to have the floor and she's going to be giving us the presentation. Commissioner, how do you prefer to handle questions? Would you like to take those as they come?
However you do.
Okay, well, maybe what we should do is, Commissioner, if you're planning to present, sort of give us an overview of direct care and treatment first, why don't we go through that and then we'll pause and take questions on that portion? I just want to have it flow the best. So why don't we do that, members? If you have questions sort of about the basics, we'll go through those, take those questions, and then after that, maybe we can take them as they come, because there might be more discussion. And I hope that we will have some discussion. And I would just say to members, this is, I don't think there are any dumb questions in this, in anything that we do, honestly. This is complicated stuff that we deal with. It's really important stuff. If you have a question, chances are somebody else has a question too. So please don't be shy when it comes to asking your question. So with that, I think that we can just go ahead and welcome the commissioner and please go ahead and give us your presentation.
Well, thank you very much, Chair Liebling, members of the committee. I'm Jody Harpstead. I have been the commissioner of the Department of Human Services now almost exactly a year. It will be 1 year on Thursday. And as she said, the chair has asked me to begin with an overview of our direct care and treatment services and then talk about our recent decisions with you. So first of all, I'm having trouble getting people's pictures off of my own slide so I can read my own slide. There we go. All right. So our direct care and treatment, we call it DCT for short, operates a wide variety of residential and treatment programs that serve people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, and chemical dependency. Our services are delivered at approximately 200 sites statewide by nearly 5,000 employees, more than 3,500 of whom live and work in Greater Minnesota. About 12,000 of the people who received our services last year. And just for comparison's sake, DCT as a behavioral health system is about the size of CentraCare in central Minnesota in terms of budget, to give you a sense of the size and scope of it. The majority of clients receiving mental health and chemical dependency treatment have been civilly committed by the courts, and all sex offenders have been civilly committed. Because their conditions are complex, their behaviors can be volatile. Other providers often cannot or will not serve them. However, some community providers do indeed. These are our programs and services. On the left, the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Our forensic services, previously known as the Security Hospital in St. Peter. Our Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. We have several community behavioral hospitals, behavioral health hospitals across Minnesota. We've recently opened our only child and adolescent behavioral health hospital. We have our substance abuse treatment services that we call CARES, and our intensive residential treatment services for people with mental illness that we call ERTS. We operate 5 specialty care dental clinics, our state-operated group homes for people with developmental disabilities, and then, of course, we have the centralized operations and other central services. Next slide. Our forensic services provides evaluation and treatment to clients statewide who've been civilly committed by the courts as mentally ill and dangerous or under other commitments that present a public safety risk. So our major program in St. Peter provides long-term treatment to adults who've been civilly committed. On average, patients are there for about 7 years. Again, formerly known as the Minnesota Security Hospital. The forensic nursing home is on the same campus, a secure facility that provides care to elderly and infirm clients who've been civilly committed as mentally ill and dangerous, sexually psychopathic or sexually dangerous, or prisoners under the jurisdiction of the Department of Corrections who need nursing home level of care. Forensic services provides treatment to about 830 people annually, and for fiscal 21, the budget is $121 million. The Minnesota Sex Offender Program is the serves people who are court ordered to receive sex offender treatment. MSOP, as we call it, provides treatment for approximately 765 clients and by far the largest program of its kind in the nation. The Sex Offender Program in Moose Lake treats clients in the initial and primary stages of sex offender treatment. It also houses clients who refuse to participate in treatment but are committed to the facility. And currently, there are 421 clients there. The Sex Offender Program in St. Peter's serves clients that are in the final stages of treatment and are preparing for reintegration into the community. The facility also provides alternative treatment for clients for whom conventional programming is not appropriate. And our 21 budget for the Sex Offender Program is $98 million. We have several mental health and substance abuse treatment services across the state that provide service to about 1,720 individuals annually from our inpatient services at the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, our community behavioral health hospitals, our one child and adolescent behavioral health hospital, and then our regional treatment services, the intense residential treatment services, otherwise known as ERTS for people with mental illness, and our community addiction recovery enterprise, also known as CARE, for people with chemical dependency, substance use disorder. The annual budget in 21, $151 million. We have Also, a group of inpatient psychiatric hospitals. I have mentioned the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, the state's largest psychiatric hospital, serving people who have a mental illness in a campus-based setting. Many patients have complex medical histories. It's a 110-bed hospital divided into 25-bed units. Our community behavioral health hospitals provide short-term inpatient psychiatric care at 16-bed sites in communities across the state. Multidisciplinary teams use various person-centered approaches to best meet the needs of our clients. Supports can be incorporated into treatment by serving patients as close as possible to their home communities. And those are located in Alexandria, Annandale, Baxter, Bemidji, Fergus Falls, and Rochester. And now the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Hospital in Willmar provides inpatient psychiatric hospital services, a safe setting for youth who need crisis stabilization, comprehensive assessment, and intensive treatment of specialized mental health problems. Our Minnesota specialty health system serves people who have a serious mental illness, acquired brain injury, and other co-occurring conditions. Clients usually come from a hospital to one of these facilities as they transition back to living in the community. These intensive residential treatment services, or ERTs, are provided in St. Paul, Brainerd, Wadena, and Willmar. And our Community Addiction Recovery Enterprise, CARE, there's a lot of acronyms in DCT, provides inpatient chemical dependency and substance use services statewide. Services are person-centered, building on the patient's interests and capacity for growth, leading to a lifelong process of recovery. There are 5 facilities statewide located in Anoka, Carlton, Fergus Falls, St. Peter, and Willmar. We also have unique expertise in specialty care dentistry. Clients at our clinics have physical and developmental disabilities or mental illnesses, and dentists in their community either can't or won't treat them. All general dentistry services are provided, ranging from cleanings and exams to fillings, root canals, crowns, and dentures. I want to say that our specialty care dentists have particular expertise in treating these patients without restraints and other medications that regular dentists will use if they see these people. And so our specialty care dentists have developed great expertise in being able to make these patients comfortable and get through their dental work. The clinics have about 5,500 active patients who average about 3 visits a year, and they're located in Brainerd, Cambridge, Faribault, Fergus Falls, and Willmar, with an annual budget of $5 million. Our community-based services provide treatment and residential care and vocational services to individuals with developmental and physical disabilities. We provide services in 4-person residential group homes, one to four. Services include daily living skills, medical monitoring if needed, and helping clients integrate more fully into the community. DCT serves 120 homes with 350 clients statewide, for $133 million budget. We operate as a healthcare system. Marshall Smith, who is the CEO of DCT, came from a hospital administration background. And the system provides a wide range of services to individuals with behavioral health needs, provided throughout the state with 24/7 operations, including psychiatric hospitals, residential treatment sites, vocational services, secure facilities, and community clinics. And I just might add here that our DCT staff is not working from home during COVID. They are all going back to the operations in these sites and continuing their normal work in an abnormal way, making sure that people are safe and distanced. And we have a really great track record of handling the COVID virus quite effectively in these services. The centralized operations serve as the core of DCT, which includes our medical director and physicians, central pre-admission, which oversees admissions and discharges across the state, medical records, the Office of Special Investigation, which monitors people on provisional discharge, financial management, and facilities management for our 200 physical locations. These are critical to the operations of any health system, and without these, the agency would be out of compliance and unable to function. So just a reminder that the centralized operations of DCT are not all lawyers and accountants. They are generally medical personnel, and it's these medical personnel that have gotten the system through the COVID pandemic thus far.
So Commissioner, Mr. McCall tells me that we should probably pause after that slide, that last one. Maybe this would be a good moment, if it would be okay with you, and see if we have questions. But before we do that, I forgot to announce before that we do have a quorum, and this is an informational hearing, so we've decided we're not going to take the roll, but our committee LA, Ms. Niedernhofer, will be noting who's here. So your attendance will definitely be noted, but since we're not an official hearing, we do have a quorum. So are there questions, members, to any of what you just heard? And I know that there's a lot of information there, went by really fast. Don't expect you to memorize the budget numbers off of those slides for sure. And I think that we'll be talking about that. So Representative Akam has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for being here today, and congratulations on your one-year anniversary. It's been quite a challenging year for you and for all in state government, I guess. My question is, you talked a lot about the services that we provide, and it seems to me that in what I've learned in my time in the legislature and from friends and family who've utilized services in this area, that we aren't necessarily meeting the need. And so you're talking about what services we have and what facilities we have. Do we have any idea what percentage of the need we are meeting? And so then maybe that also begs the question, what's the unmet? What are we not able to provide to people when we hear about the, you know, the jails as being places where oftentimes people who are having problems with mental health have to stay until they can find a place for a bed and so forth. And so just wondering if you have any idea about the unmet need that we have in our state.
I can speak very briefly about that. Sorry, Chair Liebling and members. And Sue Abderholden from NAMI is with you today, and she may have more information about the overall need in the state. But I can tell you that when the regional treatment centers closed many, many years ago, we were just talking about this the other day, one of the best things that ever happened for people with developmental disabilities who got out of those major institutions and into four-person group homes in the community, one of the toughest things that happened to people with mental illness. Minnesota, as almost every state in the nation, has underfunded mental health services for decades. And so there's always an unmet need in mental health. I will say that our system functions fairly well. People being able to be assigned to come to one of our services out of incarceration and or directly committed from the courts. We do keep people flowing through. There are sometimes log jams where we are unable to discharge people to community settings as quickly as we would like or anyone else would like. But for the most part, it flows fairly smoothly. We've been able to continue that flow of people out into community settings during COVID. So I was really pleased with that. That's something we watched on a daily basis. So the system works fairly well as it's designed. But of course, mental health services are underfunded generally across the state.
Representative Akam, thank you for that question. I just want to note that's a thank you for kind of stepping back and taking that broad view. I think that's a really important perspective for us to keep in mind as we move forward here with this. Question from Representative Baker and then Bierman. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the kind of the open invitation to ask these dumb questions because I've always wanted to sort of understand the differences between kind of the MSOCS division, if you could, with folks that are helping adults and children with disabilities and group homes and things and bringing them out in the communities to the folks that are not under the state umbrella. I'm on the board for West Central Industries, and we do a lot of the same type of a thing for engagement with workers and employers. But there's a big difference in cost for those services. And I want to ask, I guess, the question to the commissioner is, are those clients served by the state much different than the ones that are not served by those non-state places? And I've seen the cost challenges or differences before. You've mentioned some big numbers of what we have to pay for those. But are those clients that we're serving in those other group homes, are they about the same? Are we? Do you think we're duplicating some services, or are they actually a higher need class that we need to work on? I've always wanted to know the difference there. If you could help me with that.
That is an excellent question. I often, Chair Liebling and members, that's an excellent question. I often had the same question when I was at Lutheran Social Service managing 100 group homes and the industry often wondering what the difference really was. In 2017, we were asked by the legislature after a legislative audit report to transition our group homes for people with developmental disabilities without really high need out to community providers and to focus our attention and our resources on people who did have the higher needs. And we've been in that process now for several years. And so today I would say more and more the DCT group homes are serving people with some of the highest needs that are hard to serve in other places. I know that community providers are providing service to people with higher need all the time also, often high medical need. But the DCT homes tend to serve people with higher behavioral health needs and also often people with criminal records, which is less common in the community provider arena. And so for the last several years, the system has gone through a very smooth process of contacting community providers and asking if they wanted to take over some of the homes, including continuing to employ the staff and serve the same clients. And that's gone very, very nicely. It's produced a nice sort of tiered level of care where people who are sitting in hospitals and crisis centers with no place to be discharged are often now coming to the DCT group homes for a period of time. And after they're stabilized there, then often they move to a community-based provider setting. And so that's going quite nicely in terms of a nice tiered level of service across the state. The DCT group homes have been subject to the same DWRS, this term you may remember hearing from the disabilities world, rate setting system, and have often then had to ask for county exemptions for or exceptions, I should say, for the people that they support to cover the extra cost of the staffing and additional training that needs to happen to serve people with higher need. And so there is a bit of a flaw in the system right now as we have transitioned to these higher need people that doesn't come with an automatic adjustment on the way these homes are funded. And so we've been making do so far with county exceptions to meet people with higher need. But there's been some talk, especially with our legislative chairs of our Health and Human Services committees, about reexamining the cost structure and the payment plans for these particular group homes.
Thank you. That was very helpful. Oh.
Thank you for that question, Representative Baker. I almost feel like maybe the commissioner fed you that one because you kind of hit a central question about what we're talking about here. So thank you. Also, I just do want to say that, and I think the commissioner is going to get to this in her slides, that part of what makes this area so complicated is that these services, even the state services, also bill for their services where they can. So we have this complicated, maybe you gathered that from her response, but so they're also billing Medicaid or billing even private providers sometimes for the services they're providing in addition to being funded by state appropriations. So Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here today. And I have a couple questions, but I actually had an additional one based on what Representative Baker just asked. And that is, as I read some of the notes in preparation for this meeting, I was concerned about the closing down and the transfer of these patients to other facilities in order to make this savings happen. And so my question is related to what you were just talking about. Is the state going to be saving money by closing them down, but more importantly, are the patients themselves going to maintain the same level of care, in your opinion? I know that's what we all want. And I'm just wondering what your, you know, ability to give us some peace of mind that that services will not be reduced for them.
Yeah. So, yes, Chair Liebling and Representative, it certainly would be our expectation and has been, as we've been doing this transition, that people get the same level of care that they've gotten from DCT services. I'm not sure yet, and so I'm eager to talk to more community providers and get an update on their budgets and understand the question about savings. There's been a lot of discussion and debate in the last few years about that and whether or not and by how much they have lower costs. During the last few years, as you know, there's been a workforce shortage, and it's been hard to keep up with that and having to pay people more to retain staff and offer better healthcare benefits. I don't know right now in 2020 what the differential might be between state-operated group home budgets and community provider group home budgets. So I'm eager to learn more about that myself. And as we talk about some of our other services and the possibilities of community providers stepping in, I'm also eager to ask those questions and find out what the differences might be.
Representative Bierman, did you have a second?
I do, and hopefully it can be a brief question. It's just regarding, I was surprised in the presentation that the numbers of our individuals committed in St. Peter in the MSLP program were nation leading as far as numbers go. So my question is, what do other states do? How do they manage such people? And also, in terms of our, you know, the entire direct care division, does Minnesota also lead the nation in all of these other services we're providing? If you could give us an overview, I'd appreciate it. Thanks.
Chair Liebling and Representative, I don't know the answer to your last question, so I'll have to go back and ask about whether our DCT services are how they compare to other states. But as I went up to the Moose Lake Sex Offender Program and heard from the people who run it about its history and its development, they're the ones who told me that it's the largest by far in the nation. You may remember the story of the murder of Drew Shadeen many years ago in Minnesota, and it was a reaction to that that our very large sex offender program was developed. And again, exceeds the size of other state programs. And so I assume, though I should be sure of this, I assume that other states have people finish their time incarceration and then are released to the community without the sex offender program in between.
And Representative Bierman, thank you for that question too. And this is something that the legislature has wrestled with, and the administration, whatever that administration was, has wrestled with from time to time over the years, because we do have a very large and, of course, very expensive program. And I think when I was on a commission some years ago about this, looking at this, and different states, they're kind of all over the place in the way that they do this, and things might have changed. I think this is a subject very much worth looking at, because to me, the real question is, do we get public safety? What are we getting for this? Are we really getting the public safety that we hope we are? And are we really treating people as the program is set up to do? That's what it's ostensibly there for, is to treat people. And so I think it would be worth, in this era of budget cutting, one of my goals is to try to use data, whatever data we have, to try to make the best decisions to fund the things that work and not fund the things that don't when we have to make those really difficult decisions, to have them be data-driven as much as possible. So I appreciate your interest in that, and I hope other members are interested in it as well, because we do spend a lot of money there. Commissioner.
Yes, Chair Liebling, I just wanted to add that in meeting with the staff, as I did, and hearing the history and the development of our sex offender program, I also heard from them that they have the historic data shows zero reoffense from people coming through our sex offender program. So we're very proud of its effectiveness. And yet we can continue to talk from a policy standpoint about its size and budget.
Thank you. Okay, well, Commissioner, why don't you go ahead and also some of the issues that Representative Bierman had touched on are going to be more in the next set of slides. And I see Representative Keel has a question too. And Representative Keel, does it relate to this or to what we've been talking about? Or do you want to wait with that one until we get through this next section? Representative Keel?
There, am I unmuted?
There we go. Yep. Okay.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I do have just kind of a statement. We can talk about it as we go forward, but I am the home of Drew Shadeen, that accident. And also went to school with the perpetrator. So I know the family and know Mr. I can't think of his name right now. But my concern is when we talk about reoffenders, the family, when he was let go, and I wasn't in the legislature, but I remember the conversation about letting someone out. Even the family was questioning whether or not that person should even be released at all. And I remember when he was released, a couple of my classmates were raped by him, and one is deceased now, but they were fearful of even leaving their houses, and actually an instructor also. So it was, my concern is what are we doing with those who we do not feel can manage in life and cannot be turned around? I certainly want to rehab anybody who can change their style of life. But as we go forward, you know, how do we deal with those people who we just don't want in society again or cannot handle it? So,
yeah. And let me just say, Representative Keel, thank you for that. And your concerns, we all share them. Absolutely, we do. And, you know, since those days, one of the things that did happen is that sentences got longer. You know, back in those days when that man was let out, sentences were shorter. And so a lot of things have changed. And so it's really a question of, you know, not should we do what we can do to ensure safety? Absolutely, we should. We all know there are people who should never be walking around free. They just can never be safe. But we also need to look at what we're doing, I think. And this is another very long conversation for another day, but it's just correct. One piece of this. But, you know, I think everything we do, we should look at it periodically to see if the money we're spending is getting us what we think, and whether there are, you know, we just have to, because we will always have limited public dollars and we have to make very tough decisions. And we're at one of those points now where very, very tough decisions are going to have to be made. So, you know, I hear you. I think you're expressing a very, very important viewpoint in all of this. And I'm sure we're going to hear more in the other areas that DCT works with as well. So thank you for that. So go ahead, Commissioner. We'll move on through the next set.
So starting on the right side of this slide, we started 20 calendar 2020 in the first session of the legislature with a $38 million deficit in direct care and treatment. This was due to higher salary and healthcare costs and the aforementioned need to take a look at the billing structure of our group homes. And then over time, we came down to a $27 million deficit. Part of it, the additional funds came from a COVID response fund piece of funding that came our way as a result of the COVID leaves that we had to pay for in the beginning half of the year. And also we had a revised, a better forecast on our revenue. So the deficit came down to $27 million. And that's what we've been working to tackle since the fourth session this year, where we didn't get the operating adjustment we had asked for in the governor's supplemental budget. And so you can see the $27 million deficit from 2021 at the top of the page. And at the bottom, we were facing a $96 million deficit for the following biennium, if nothing changed. Wanted to give you an idea of our budget in DHS and the budget in DCT. And actually, this helped me, too, to finally put this on a pie chart so we could all kind of get a sense of how this works. If you look at the heading on this slide, the DHS general fund budget, this is the $6.9 billion that comes to DHS from the state general fund. So on the left, you see the large pie chart with our forecasted programs, our the group homes for people with disabilities we pay for across the state to community providers, our homelessness programs, our Medicaid programs, and all of our MFIP programs, SNAP food programs, all of our forecasted programs take 85% of that budget. Our grant programs, the things you're familiar with that the legislature approves and asks us to implement in the state of Minnesota, about 6% of our budget, and everything else adds up to 9%. That 9% breaks out on the right. 6% of it funds the direct care and treatment program that we've been talking about. IT systems, our other human services administrations, and operations, central operations in DHS is the last 3% of the total budget. So the forecast programs, by far the largest part of our state general fund spending. This is the DCT budget. This was extremely helpful for me to get a handle on, and I hope for you as well. If you look at the right side of this pie chart, you see it up at 1 o'clock. The blue wedge is our forensic services at the security, what was called Security Hospital in St. Peter, 22%. The sex offender program at 17%. The Anoka Regional Treatment Center at 10%. And those three programs together account for 49% of all of DCT. And are the kinds of programs that only we can offer and that we are required by statute to make available. Down at 7 o'clock, you see the rust-colored wedge, which is our state-operated group homes, 21% of the budget. The next one is our community behavioral health, our six hospitals. And then you can see the little slivers here are the special care dental clinics, the one child and adolescent behavioral health hospital, our substance abuse treatment services that we call CARES, and our intensive residential treatment facilities that we call ERTS. And then our 14% wedge of our central operations and other services is a really model overhead rate for a health system this large. And we're pretty proud of how well we've kept those costs to where they are. But those are the kinds of costs required to run this entire behavioral health system across the state. A little bit of history. If we go back to 2015, we had budget challenges then too. And across the board cuts were made to DCT, which led to inadequate clinical staffing, increased staff injuries, and the increased use of seclusion and restraints on the patients, clients, and individuals that we served. If you don't remember that, you may well remember 2016 when the Anoka Regional Treatment Center's CMS certification was at stake and there were violent outbreaks at St. Peter Hospital. Also in 2016, as a result, Marshall Smith was hired to lead DCT and bring his background in Lean Six Sigma quality control, as well as his hospital administration background to work in DCT. We're proud that in 2020, there have been no headlines about our direct care and treatment services until last week. And also in July, all the patients, clients, and individuals across the system were COVID-free and have remained so since. So we're proud of the way that this system has handled the COVID pandemic by using all kinds of state-of-the-art health practices to make sure that our patients, clients, and individuals do not get the virus. We occasionally have employees who come from outside, obviously, and have been out in the world and test positive for COVID. And even that has not led to patients, clients, or individuals getting the virus from them. I've recently asked our senior leaders in DHS to imagine their biggest possibilities for the next 3 years. And Marshall Smith's was that DCT will achieve the readiness criteria to be an eligible candidate for the National Malcolm Baldrige Quality Award. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but the Malcolm Baldrige Quality Award is usually associated with for-profit companies. And I understand that if DCT were to actually win the Malcolm Baldrige Award, it would be the first state agency in the nation to do so. So you can see that we've gone from 2015, when budgets were cut and problems ensued, to a time in 2020 when all is stable and well, and now this big possibility of actually being eligible for a national quality award. Want to review a little bit of the legislative investments that have been made in DCT that have made substantial impacts in our ability to produce these results. Funding for increased capacity for complex needs at the AMRTC, funding for weekend coverage and clinical oversight at, this is the Anoka Treatment Center, funding to eliminate conditional licensing at forensics and increase staff there, funding to increase ERTS capacity, to increase capacity at our community behavioral health hospitals, funding for the sex offender program, community preparation services, and multiple operating adjustments to fund cost pressures. But let's not go back to 2015 to 2017 when problems occurred, because we just made across the board cuts and went on, and this was not a good way to go. So we just wanted to remind you of some of those blaring headlines. I remember reading them from outside the system. In 2013, there was an Office of Legislative Auditor review of DCT, and they suggested that the legislature should clarify in law that the mission of state-run facilities is to serve individuals who'd not be adequately served by other providers. And direction from the legislature in 2017, specifically to the group homes, we've already talked about this, for individuals with complex behavioral needs that cannot be met by private community-based providers. And so with the support of the legislature, we have transitioned more than 25 homes to private providers and opened more than 20 homes for individuals with complex behavioral needs. Balancing our budget possibilities. There are limited ways to solve this budget deficit. Requesting legislative action, receiving an operating adjustment is always welcome. Engaging in across-the-board reductions, which we're concerned about given our history. It's possible to reduce capacity, admit fewer people, and then have less staffing in core programs to just ease the pressure on the budget. And or make strategic reductions in programs and services where community providers have the expertise and capacity to serve patients and clients who would be affected by downsizing. Administrative reductions alone can't do it. You saw the pie charts, and DCT is unable to reduce administrative and support budgets enough to close this gap, and they're critical to maintaining effective operations, as we've already said. And so our progress in getting back to normal and stable and strong would be in jeopardy if we just cut administration. And I think this slide says the same thing in as many words. When we just reduced cost across the board, we had lots of problems, poor quality, safety, compliance, inability to recruit and retain staff. And so with all that's been done to improve quality, safety, and patient outcomes with a really well-run system today, we don't want to return to that. And then if we decrease our capacity or staffing, that reduces, this was in response to a question earlier, that reduces the availability of critical services. Patients experience delays in admission. They can be stuck in community hospitals or jails awaiting treatment. And DCT would risk being out of compliance with the priority admission statute or the 48-hour rule, where we need to have beds available when people are committed to our services. Further compliance issues could jeopardize accreditation again and our ability to bill for services, because we do bill Medicaid for many of our services and other health insurance as well. And then counties who rely on DCT for placement of behavioral challenged patients would be greatly impacted, having to find places themselves for people to go. And so another option for consideration is what we call the strategic reductions of focusing on closing or transitioning patients to community providers, and which would allow us to focus again on high need individuals for which no other services are available. And so we're wondering if some of our other services should also go the way of the group homes and be considered for transfer to community providers, allowing us to serve only the highest need individuals. We are constrained in simply making those decisions by Minnesota Statute 246.129, which says that if the closure of a state-operated facility is proposed and the department and respective bargaining units fail to arrive at a mutually agreed-upon solution to transfer affected state employees to other state jobs, the closure of the facility requires legislative approval. This does not apply to state-operated enterprise services. So our enterprise services are those that bill Medicaid for their revenue, such as our dental clinics. The state-operated facilities that are referred to here are, for example, the Security Hospital in St. Peter, the Sex Offender Program, et cetera. So legislative and labor collaborations on these kinds of opportunities could ensure that DCT maintains a high level of quality and compliance in its core services, like the Regional Treatment Center, forensics, and the Sex Offender Program. So this is what we've done so far and announced this past week. Our plan is to do program reductions beginning September 1st. The first is, you may remember from a few slides back, with the problems that occurred at the St. Peter Security Hospital, the legislature allocated new positions to better staff up St. Peter Hospital. We are now sitting with 44 new positions that were just allocated to us. They were allocated like several positions a year for 3 years. And we just received this year's allocation of 44 open, never used positions. And we believe that the St. Peter Hospital is now in fine shape and does not need them. And so we would eliminate those future positions. And then because our transition of group homes to community providers has gone as smoothly as it has and been a benefit to all, as far as we can tell, we would like to accelerate the transition of group homes to community providers, putting more of our homes on that list and making it available to community providers who may have interest in picking up the work. And then this week, we've made the decision, the difficult decision, to discontinue the sex offender program inside the Moose Lake Correctional Facility, which eliminates 15 positions. Though I would add that we expect half of those positions, the people in those positions, to find other work in Moose Lake at our sex offender program somewhere, but we are closing the one inside the correctional facility. And then, because we didn't want to reduce any of our other services at this time, until we had a chance to look at the possibility of transitioning them. So in order to preserve programs and jobs in greater Minnesota, we are taking some pretty tough hits to the administrative costs in DCT, such as justifications for hiring, making it harder to hire new people, cutting recruitment and retention budgets, salary savings leaves, et cetera, and similar efforts in DHS, slowing hiring, reducing training and supply, salary savings leaves. These are temporary actions for the rest of fiscal 21, hopefully restoring them in 22, depending on what 22 looks like. And so we want to start with these kinds of changes. This results in the elimination of a total of 15 positions and still leaves a gap of $7.1 million in fiscal 21 and $70.7 million in fiscal 22 and 23. We are pleased, however, that we've gotten this far this early in the year. And so we have a bit of time here yet to talk and socialize our possibilities and find out whether there are other options with community providers and have a chance to continue to achieve our fiscal 21 budget and put a dent in the 22-23 budget.
Commissioner, we have a question from There's a question from Representative Jordan. I don't know if this would be a good moment for that. I don't know what the question is. Representative Jordan?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Commissioner, for making time to walk through this with all of us. I think this budget shortfall is concerning to a number of, to all of us, really. But I have some big questions about how these cuts were determined and what input from patients and their families and our staff, all of the people who provide these services, how were they consulted about these changes and these proposals that DCT is making?
Mm-hmm. Chair Liebling and Representative, we've spent weeks talking with the management team at DCT and DHS. We've had three consultations with our labor bargaining unit in this time, and they've been very helpful. Some of the administrative changes you see were suggested by our bargaining unit. We have not talked with the families.
Madam Chair.
Representative Jordan.
And Commissioner, are there plans to do so? I think there's a lot of concerns for, as you've mentioned, some of these cuts in the past have really impacted patient care and the individuals that we really provide these services for.
We can consider that. It's not typical, but we can take a look at that.
Okay. Thank you. And Representative Jordan, thank you for that question. In fact, you know, part of the reason that we're having this hearing today is to bring some transparency to all of this and give the public an opportunity to weigh in, because although these are, the department is kind of under the gun to get some of these things going, as you all, I hope, are starting to understand, this is only the beginning of some cuts that have to be made or, you know, changes. Well, somehow we either have to come up with more money, we have to do some more closures, we have to cut some services, something to deal with this both this year and in the next biennium. And this is these are issues that really impact the entire state. And it's important for us, I think, as legislators to understand this ourselves. And then hopefully some of the input will come through you as you and have conversations with your constituents, and all of us do. So, you know, that's kind of part of our function as legislators and a lot of the reason why we're having this hearing today. So thank you for that question.
Madam Chair, may I ask another question?
Sure.
Thank you. If we had passed the governor's supplemental budget, or if we passed a supplemental budget, would we still be discussing these cuts?
Yes, Chair Liebling, Representative, that is a very good question. I would say that we have been throughout 2020 waiting to see if the governor's supplemental budget would pass and we would get our operating adjustment. Our operating adjustment would have been sufficient to get us to our fiscal 21 budget. We went into the year knowing that what we were asking for was to get us through our 21 budget. I do have to tell you that since we all saw the headlines about the re-estimated state deficit for the next biennium, we have turned a corner inside our management team and said, oh my goodness, if we don't start working on the biennium and thinking about what that's going to be now and incorporating that into our thinking now, we're going to run out of time to be able to make the budget in the next biennium. So we're very concerned now about still looking at possible solutions during fiscal 21 so that we are better able to even begin to achieve our budget for the biennium 22 and 23. And so we're more focused now on all of that than just getting ourselves through 21. So again, if we had gotten that operating adjustment, we would have been okay for 21, but we still would have seen that headline and we'd still be saying, oh my, what else do we need to do if we're gonna ever achieve that biennium budget going forward? So thank you for asking.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Commissioner, why don't you go ahead and show us the last few slides and then we will have some more discussion. Or we have some testifiers as well, of course.
All right. So we've been over that and here we are. So one possibility is to be exploring partnerships with community providers to transition additional DHS facilities to maintain services and jobs and local presence. since the 70s. The capacity among community providers in these things that we do has grown faster than our state-operated services. And so a lot of these services have become largely community-driven. For instance, there are now more than 60 residential mental health programs and more than 130 residential substance use disorder programs being operated by community providers, and just a handful now by the state-operated services. Community-based providers have greater flexibility to focus on local needs and partner with local health systems. DCT uses a centralized admissions process, which can send somebody anywhere in the state and not close to their family or their home. And we look at things across the state. If we had community-based providers who had community employees and partnerships with local health systems, that actually might even work better than what we have today. And so we are in the process of discussing creative strategies to control costs with our labor partners, the legislature, the mental health community, and other stakeholders to further develop options to control these costs. Time is running out. I already said that. Without some agreement to provide funding or permit actions to achieve some cost savings before about December, DCT will have a critical budgetary shortfall. Actions that could eliminate the remaining deficit lose impact over time. We estimate that for every month that goes by, we're going to have to look at cutting $2 million more to get through fiscal 2021. And so we're eager to continue looking at possibilities right away and not just wait. And of course, it takes time to do these changes. Closing a program requires notifying bargaining units, regulators, referral sources, stopping admissions, developing discharge plans for existing clients, issuing layoff letters, assisting staff with options, and even after closure, dealing with leases, contractual obligations, and employee separation costs. Options are limited, as you've seen from our slide before. Just cutting administration doesn't do it. We are pleased to have reduced the fiscal 21 deficit from 27 million to 7.1 without deeper reductions to services or further job losses. We will need to collaborate with the legislature, our labor partners, counties, tribes, providers, and advocates to figure out the rest. And we would be particularly interested in working with all of you to consider the transition of some more of our services to community providers, which has the potential of keeping local services available, local facilities open, and local jobs intact. And now, I'd be interested to answer any more questions.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. I have not seen any more questions here. Let's just give it a moment in case anybody, or if you're on visual and you aren't being called on, raise your hand, wave your hand. Okay, Representative Grunhagen, please.
Oh, thank you, Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for the update. And I agree with you about the reductions. Is there available any type of comparative analysis with the surrounding five states in terms of services and cost that we can compare what we're doing with the surrounding five states? Now, that doesn't mean that if we're doing it and they're not, that we have to make a change. But as lay people, which almost all of us, if not all of us, are, the best way for us to assess things is to have a comparative analysis. And either nationally, which is hard, I know, or the surrounding five states. You know, when I was on the school board, when we did our fiscal analysis once a year, the auditor would give us a comparative analysis of other districts with similar sized enrollment. And we could see where we were out of whack, and maybe there was a good reason for it, or we were spending less. And that was very helpful for us as school board members. Is there a comparative analysis available on the services and costs that we provide compared to the other surrounding five states.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Commissioner.
Yes, Chair Liebling and Representative, that's a really good question. And this might be a perfect time for us to reach out and discover that right now as we continue to explore our options. That's a very good question. One of the things I've done some since I started is to focus my attention on the other states that are state-funded, county-administered, because that gives us some comparison to states that operate our human services like we do in Minnesota. And we know who those folks are, and we might have some opportunity to reach out. It's also possible that our friends at NAMI, who you're going to hear from here shortly, and other nationwide professional organizations might have some data for us as well. So that's a very good question to ask. My general experience when traveling around the country is Minnesota tends to rank fairly highly on the kinds of services that we provide the citizens of our state. But it would be worth a check. Thanks for asking.
Chair Liebling?
Representative Grunhagen, please.
Yeah, how soon could we have an analysis like that for committee members?
Commissioner?
Yeah, Chair Liebling and Representative, I have no idea. That's a good question. but I'll ask right away, and we'll see if one's already available. That's possible that there's some data that's already out there, and that would be fast. Studying it, calling other states, you know, would take some time. So I'll have to see what's already available.
Chair Liebling, one more follow-up?
Yeah. Yes, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, it just amazes me that in the age of technology, where we got numbers run for almost everything from a comparative basis, that we wouldn't have available comparative services and numbers for areas such as this. It almost seems like there is a desire not to have that type of information available. And I'm not blaming you or anybody else, but I'm just saying in general, when it comes to state and federal government, we get these broad cost analysis, but we don't get any type of comparative analysis. And again, for lay people, comparative analysis of programs and cost is one of the best ways for us to participate in the process rather than just blindly going forward and making reductions without completely realizing what the consequences are. And I don't think any of us want to do that. So I hope that you would, Commissioner, put a lot of effort into trying to come up with this type of information for us committee members as we go forward. Thank you, and thanks for your consideration.
Well, thank you, Representative Grunhagen. You know, I think there's a disconnect there, though, in what you just said. I mean, I think it can be useful, as you say, to get comparative analyses and just to see what others are doing. That can be informative. And we do that at different times for different things. As the commissioner was saying, though, it's not always apples to apples. So you have to be careful about that. But the second thing you said that for me was a bit of disconnect was that we don't then understand the impact of what we're doing. And I think that understanding the impact of what we're doing, I agree that that's super important. That's something I very much want to do as we go forward here. But just looking at other states is not, that doesn't necessarily inform us about the impact of what we're doing. I think we have to be very careful. And for me, I've always believed that part of Minnesota's culture, at least as long as I've been in the legislature and before, was that Minnesotans take great pride in providing good services for people who are vulnerable. So disability services, we all just went through a lot of work around one little sector of disability services, that being the day services. And there was a lot of concern among members, and rightly so, about what are we doing for people with disabilities. So I think this has been a strong part of our culture. As was pointed out earlier, we may not reach the goals that we have set. We are not necessarily taking care of the concerns that are out there. But I think that we do take pride in not necessarily being the lowest in the pack as well. So I think we need to, you know, it's important to compare, but it's also important to keep in mind what our own citizens expect of us here in the state. So we are going to be definitely wrestling with all these things, and I appreciate you bringing that up. Commissioner, did you have, I think we had another question here from Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll keep it quick because I know I've already had the opportunity. But as we talk about transitioning some of our programs, particularly some of our MSOCs and other programs to community partners, how are we determining that? What's the prioritization for which MSOCs or which facilities or which positions we are looking to transfer to community or private partners?
Commissioner?
Chair Liebling and Representative, I don't know the actual exact algorithm that our staff has been using to do this for the last several years. I do know that generally the objective was to transition homes that are filled with people who could easily be served and by community providers. So we're really looking at the people in them to get an idea. And then, of course, we're looking at the local community to see where there are other providers who have the capacity to take on other services. But it's been a good and thoughtful process. We have been working one county at a time to figure out how to transition some of these homes. And the idea of accelerating, one idea that's been suggested is statewide RFI, so we can find out where the providers are across the state who might have capacity and good ideas about how to do this, just to give us more information as we pursue that particular strategy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Okay, Commissioner, you had some more slides, didn't you, or are we at the end?
No, I'm finished. Thank you, Chair.
Oh, you did. Okay, you finished. Okay, very good. So I think we can go to our testifiers now, and just to make members aware, the intention was to go until 11:45. So just so everyone's aware of that. So let's go then to Sue Abderholden, who's been hanging on here waiting. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. And thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. You know, I think it's important to look at just a tiny bit of the history of state-operated services. You know, in the early 1900s, state-operated services, or DCT, were really the only game in town. That was the only place that you went for treatment and services. And that began to change in the 70s and 80s, partly due to court cases as well, and really recognizing that people could be served in the community. Unfortunately, for people with mental illnesses, we were treated a little differently. So Medicaid discriminates against mental health treatment by limiting its use of its dollars to facilities that have 16 beds or less. Medicare has a lifetime limit on the paying for the number of inpatient psychiatric bed days. And private insurance, of course, as we know, does not pay for all the various types of mental health treatment. So it isn't that we have a broken mental health system. It's because we actually never built it. I think as we kind of look at what's happening today in terms of budget cuts, I think it's important to really, again, discuss what is the role of state-operated services. While they used to be the largest player in town, they are no longer. Our community providers serve far more people than the state does. We have roughly 150,000 people who live with a serious mental illness. So clearly most of those people are actually served in the community. I think the other thing to remember is, you know, at the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, yes, they serve people who are committed, largely people who are committed from jail. But again, that's a small number. About 4,000 people have a commitment filed every year. And a lot of those people are actually served in community hospitals because they couldn't get into Anoka if they wanted to. HCMC has 100 beds. Regions has about 100 beds. UM Health Fairview has actually a lot more, about 175. And as the commissioner mentioned, we have over 60 ERTS providers in the community as well. And so it really is now a small part of our mental health system. And I think we need to continue to kind of look at, so what is the role? We would say that we are actually okay with moving the ERTS facilities, in particular, to community providers. I think there will be greater continuity of care, especially if it's run by a CCBHC, Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinic. They're already providing a wide array of services. This would just be another part, and I think that that actually would work really well. The community behavioral health hospitals are a little bit differently, although I will say that they are not managed as how we initially thought they would be. We thought they would be a far greater part of the community, so creating great relationships with the hospitals and community mental health providers. But to be honest, centralized admission has made that hard. So people are coming from other regions of the state because there's an empty bed. It's not necessarily serving just the people in their particular region. I know there were some questions about, you know, how do we compare it to other states? It is a difficult thing to do. There have been some studies out there. Typically, Minnesota is in the top 10, which in some ways, frankly, is sad that we're in the top 10, because I think we are not remotely meeting the needs of people, and there's a lot more that we need to do there. In some of the studies that have been done, there was one by the Treatment Advocacy Center, and they looked at the number of beds per population, and they said that Minnesota ranked about last. But the caveat here is that the number one state was Mississippi. And that's because Mississippi has not developed any community services, and the report only looked at state-operated beds, which, again, we have far more community hospital beds, so that report doesn't really help us. Our national office actually did two studies about 10 years ago, and they tried to kind of measure what, you know, states were doing. The problem was they didn't include Medicaid benefits. Well, prior to 2007, a lot of services for people with mental illnesses were actually paid for by county funds and state funds, not by Medicaid. We shifted that because we said we should be treating this as any other healthcare issue. But our national office could not actually quantify the Medicaid dollars that were spent on mental health. So again, it's kind of a difficult report because you're only looking at county funds and state funds and not actually Medicaid or Minnesota Care funds. I would say that Minnesota has a wide array of services, which is a good thing. That's what we want. There are things that we're certainly short on, including first episode programs, supportive housing, more intensive services for children. So we have a lot of work to do, as do other states. But I think generally speaking, we're doing a little bit better. So I guess I would just say that as we're moving forward, this is an opportunity to, again, relook at the mission of state-operated services. Certainly, Anoka, with its locked units, certainly the security hospital, we definitely need those. You know, perhaps in the future, sometime in the future, we can figure out what to do with the community behavioral health hospitals. But we would support moving the ERTS facilities to community providers who are already doing the lion's share of that work. So again, thank you for allowing me to be here today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Right. Thank you very much, Ms. Abderholden. Are there any questions for Ms. Abderholden? Okay, I'm not seeing any right now, but if you would just stick around, we have some other testifiers, and there may be questions that come up as we move along here. So thank you. So next on my list, I have Lynn Butcher from MAPE. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairperson Liebling and members of the committee. Thank you for letting me speak this morning. My name is Lynn Butcher. I serve as the quality officer supporting Forensic Services Division of Direct Care and Treatment. And I am also the statewide secretary for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, a member-driven union representing over 15,000 state employees, including nearly 2,500 at the Department of Human Services. 4 years ago, when I first testified in front of this committee, it was to convince it that issues of safety and burnout at the Minnesota Security Hospital could be mitigated by hiring 125 additional staff identified through joint labor management collaboration. Today, I'm here to share with you the impact of the DHS administration's unilateral decision to eliminate 44 of those positions, as well as a unit of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, and accelerate the privatization of over 30 adult foster care homes in order to close the $27 million budget shortfall for which no supplemental appropriation was provided. For my colleagues in community-based services, the decision to privatize their workplaces means an increase in uncertainty. Uncertainty over whether the individuals they serve will receive the same high-quality care from a private provider that they do from a stable state workforce, and uncertainty for themselves as they see their system dismantled. For my colleagues in the MSOP, these cuts mean a loss of 8 MAPE-represented positions and an increase to already unmanageable caseloads, as well as a continuation of unsafe clinical practice as therapists are asked to facilitate treatment groups alone in order to maintain high levels of treatment while providing time for clinicians to complete documentation requirements. For my colleagues at Forensic Services, where I serve, the elimination of these 44 positions means a loss of hope. Hope for a future with reasonable workloads and sufficient staff to cover newly opened treatment units. Hope for an end to mandated overtime for unit staff. Hope to be able to maintain safety in our programs. Hope that decision makers can look beyond a number on a spreadsheet and see the person it represents. Hope that collaboration with agency leadership could actually occur. And hope that the legislature will work quickly enough to find common ground and a commitment to ensuring strong supportive mental health system for Minnesota by prioritizing the passage of deficiency funding for this fiscal year. We know the work that we do for Minnesota is vital. You can confirm for us that you know this by working with your legislative colleagues to fund our programs and make that commitment to us. Thank you for hearing me this morning. I appreciate the time to speak.
Thank you very much, Ms. Butcher. We appreciate you being here with us today. And I'm not seeing questions, but if you could stick around with us, there may be some later on. Thank you. Okay, Eric Hesse, welcome.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Eric Hesse, and I work as a security counselor lead in the Minnesota Sex Offender Program in St. Peter. I'm also the vice president of ASPE Local 404, which represents both MSOP and the Forensic Service Program. Thank you for the opportunity to provide frontline worker perspective on this very important matter. The proposed cuts and hiring freezes for MSOP and Forensic Services are irresponsible and dangerous. Frontline security staff is not the place to find savings. I know from firsthand experience that this will lead to more staff being assaulted and injured. First time I appeared in front of the Minnesota legislature was to tell the story of when I was assaulted at work and nearly lost one of my eyes. This happened at the Minnesota Security Hospital where staffing levels were unsafe. I know for the fact when we don't fill vacant positions, overtime levels naturally go up. We also got to keep in mind that in the fall, we may be experiencing a second wave of COVID, which will could directly impact the staffing levels there. And, when we naturally have more overtime, and overtime rates at Forensic Services is pretty up right now, the way it is without this. But when we have increased overtime rates, this leads to decreased staff morale. It leads to staff burnout, and it leads to staff injuries because people, when they're working their second or third double shift in a row, aren't as attentive, they aren't as alert as they could be, and it just could lead to bad situations. In MSOP, a couple of years ago, I believe, I don't know the exact number, but there was about 70 positions that were eliminated, and most of them were from frontline workers. And since then, we've had struggles with trying to maintain safe staffing levels on the unit, and also to provide programming for the clients. So if we go ahead with this, I just don't see how it doesn't naturally compromise the safety of the clients, staff, and quite possibly the communities. It is irresponsible on the part of the legislature to not fund safe staffing, and is irresponsible to propose fixing a budget deficit by cuts focused on frontline staff. There have been others who were not as lucky as me and have never fully recovered from injuries suffered on the job, torn ligaments, broken bones, and traumatic brain injuries. Underinvesting in our work is dangerous and the consequences severe. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hesse. We appreciate you being here today to speak to us. And again, I don't see any questions right now, but please hang around in case there are any. And then we have Melissa Thompson. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. My name is Melissa Thompson. I am a member of ASME Council 5 and president of Local 607, which represents workers across the state from all of the state-operated community service sites. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony this morning. I understand tough decisions need to be made at DHS if the legislator continues to underfund our work. But what I don't understand is why every time there is a budget shortfall or tough economic times, the first place anyone looks for savings is at the frontline workers. I have been working for the state for over 15 years, and I have never seen so many layers of management as we have today. The sort of top-heavy cut from the bottom mentality is disgusting. It's counterproductive to provide high quality services, and it has to stop. The plan to continue to transition more and more of the state operated group homes to private providers is blatantly outsourcing and only saves money by paying the workers less and cutting their benefits. When DHS does transition homes like they are suggesting to do more of, there is a process for the employees of the closing homes to be able to bid on open positions in the remaining homes and the work sites. I really question our ability to maintain that process if DHS accelerates at the pace of the outsourcing. There won't be enough open positions for the amount of workers that they will be displacing. You know, we're talking about, we have, what did you say, 17, you want to do 17 more homes, you figure about 17 homes, that's 170 staff that you would have to be able to find positions for. That's just a lot of staff that we would be displacing out of work. The legislator must step up and fund our work. Cutting our way out of this budget deficit is not the way forward. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for being here today, Ms. Thompson. We appreciate your testimony. Other questions from members? I think that is the last testifier, at least the last one on my list. Was there anyone else here who wanted to testify and maybe didn't get on the list? Okay, not seeing anybody. So are there questions from members? Okay, so not seeing any there either. So let me just make a couple comments, and we do have a little bit of time. I mean, we don't have to drag this out if folks don't have questions, but, and I know this is kind of overwhelming. There's a lot to unpack here. And the commissioner has been talking to me about this a little bit as they've been wrestling with these issues. And so I've had just a bit more of a head start than you members to ask some questions and so on. But there is a lot here, and there's a lot of detail. I think in a lot of ways, the devil is kind of in the details here. So there are some pieces of information that I'm still looking for, because just to be clear, the department is making certain decisions right now as of September 1st. But when the legislature comes back into session, or even during our special sessions, this is our responsibility, along with the administration's responsibility, to figure out how to deal with the budget. As has been noted, the House did pass the budget adjustment, the supplemental budget. We passed that off the floor once. It passed through Ways and Means on another occasion, and was ready to come up on the floor when we were told that the Senate had decided that they weren't going to deal with the budget. So it wasn't brought up on the floor for that reason. But the House has tried to do a supplemental budget. Now, that being said, we are facing a really big budget deficit. You know, money is going to be tight, and there are going to be, just to be quite frank with everyone, there are going to be cuts all over our state budget. This is going to be a very difficult time. But I feel like in order for the legislature to go forward and make good decisions, even when we have a chance to make them, it's going to be really important for us to understand the cost comparison between the group homes that are state operated and the ones that are the private operators that we're talking about transitioning to. I know another member brought this up before, but the place that I really wonder about is, since we're billing Medicaid, and the private operators are also billing Medicaid, it's not as though when we transfer people to private providers that they're suddenly off the state's dime. The state is paying through a different pocket, if you will. And I find this hard to get my mind around. We need to understand kind of the entire cost of what we're doing here. And also the costs that are not always quantifiable, kind of what Ms. Thompson was talking about, the, you know, what is the difference in care? What is the difference in acuity that was talked about before by another member? So these are all issues that we're going to need to dig into very deeply in order to make good decisions. The worst possible outcome would be for us to make what we think are necessary cuts and displacing a lot of workers, displacing perhaps some residents, changing some services, and then find out we're not even saving all that much money. That would be kind of the worst of all worlds. So we have a lot of work to do to get our minds around all these questions. And I know that the commissioner has the very, very heavy responsibility of coming up with solutions. She has to. And I really feel that it's incumbent on all of those, all of us, to share in that. I would have liked to have passed that supplemental budget. At least that would have gotten us through this budget year to where the legislature could be more engaged in making these decisions. And we may not have much of an opportunity for that right now before the next budget session. But this is going to be something that's going to be weighing on all of us. So with that, are there other questions from members? I don't want to do all the talking, but I'm not being told that anybody else has their name on the list. Is there anything anybody wants to say, either questions or just comments? Is there information that you think would be helpful? And by the way, let me bring up one other thing. I did mention this to the commissioner as well, and I think it's important. As we go forward, I think we need to understand what the equity impact of these changes are as well. So we have begun to be more cognizant as we go forward and make decisions about the impact on equity. And I have a feeling that across these various services in DCT that there are differences in what the impact is going to be on communities of color. And I think it would be helpful for us to just know what those are as we move forward as well, if we can get more of that information. Other members? Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for your comments. And so my question is simply, where and how do we get that information? Would that be supplied by Commissioner Harpstead? And if so, when I think Representative Grunhagen had asked some questions on data, as I had earlier, on this care transition cost savings, and how do we as a body get that?
Great question, Representative Bierman. So normally, and the commissioner will speak, but normally the way we do this is that, DHS has information much more than we do as a legislature, and they would supply it and hopefully to the committee administrator, and then we'll send it out to everyone so that you all have access to it. Commissioner, do you want to comment on that?
Yes, Chair Liebling and Representative, just to add very quickly, I asked a couple of months ago when all of this we started diving into this about the disaggregated racial data in our DCT services. And the very high level answer to that so far is that across the whole system, the people that we support pretty much reflect the state of Minnesota almost precisely at 80% white and 20% Black, Indigenous, and people of color. but we can get you that data and follow up with you after today.
Okay, thank you. Other questions that members have? All right, since I'm not seeing one, let me ask another one then. Mr. Hesse talked about the impact on MSOP of, I think he was talking about these positions that are going to be eliminated, that are open positions. But I'd like to just ask a little bit more about the change that's being proposed in MSOP, which is the elimination of the program that takes place inside the Moose Lake prison. Just so everybody's clear about this, there is, and I visited this program some years ago, and I don't know if it's probably changed a lot since then, but my understanding is that this is while inmates are still in the prison, that they are, certain inmates are put into this treatment program. And the hope is that by giving them treatment in the prison system, that they either will be simply safer to the public upon release because they will be treated, or that they will be less likely to be admitted to our sex offender program, which is a post-incarceration program. That's the MSOP, that program we've talked about that's so large compared to other places, is a treatment program for people who are not actually incarcerated. They are either done with their incarceration or never had one, and they're now in treatment. So this program that's being eliminated is a program that was intended, I think, to try to give people treatment while they're in prison to try to keep them out of that longer term program. And so I'm interested in just understanding a little bit more, if you could, about whether eliminating that program has an impact on public safety or an impact on, you know, whether we're just moving the expense from one place to another by having more people go into our long-term program. If you could comment on that, Commissioner.
Yes, Chair Liebling, I'd probably have to get some more information from Marshall Smith in terms of his logic and thinking that this was the place to make a change. Though I will say that our sex offender program at Moose Lake on the same campus is still there and has 471 employees. And so, yes, it would be a shift to our other sex offender programs. But I could get more information from Marshall Smith and get back to you about that.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Okay. Not seeing any. Yes, please, Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just, I had a question for Ms. Abderholden. When she was speaking about the ERTS program and shutting of that program down, she mentioned that she was okay with the transfers going to CCHBC clinics. And I was just curious if there are enough of those in the state to handle the numbers of that program. And just wanted to hear a little bit more also about her concerns about the hospitals.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Bierman. Because we already have community providers actually running about a little over 60 ERTS facilities already, I have no concerns about doing that. And we have many providers that are looking to add ERTS facilities as well around the state. So many of them are really very well equipped to do that. My concern about the community behavioral health hospitals is that they were designed to kind of be regional. As we closed down the last beds at, say, you know, Fergus Falls and Brainerd and places like that, Wilmer, and they were supposed to serve that region. But centralized admission has made that very difficult to do. So someone contacts centralized admission, perhaps they've been committed, they look at where there's an empty bed and they send them there. So they aren't necessarily serving people in their region, they might be serving people from other places. And I do think that hinders our ability to do good discharge planning. How do we get people back home? You know, maybe they're not as familiar with the other community providers, where the person, you know, came from. So this has been an issue that we've raised for some time. So we really would still like the department to really look at that to make sure that they're really part of the community in those regions and not just a statewide resource. Does that answer your question?
Just one follow-up, please, Madam Chair. Regarding the hospitals, are there also Minnesota patients that are sent out of state because the beds are not available?
Dr. Holden?
And Representative Bierman, yes, particularly our border states. So we have a lot of people that do go to the hospital in North Dakota and in Sioux Falls because we don't have enough hospital beds, generally speaking. And again, just remembering that most of our beds are in community hospitals, not necessarily run by the state. And so that is an issue, though, that they are going to border state hospitals. And we have enough beds, frankly, that are banked. If you look at the licensed, just general hospital beds in the state of Minnesota, we have many beds that are not being used that are banked that they did before the certificate of need process. So if a hospital wanted to add beds, they wouldn't even have to go through the certificate of need process. They could just add them. The main reason we've seen for hospitals not adding psychiatric beds is, frankly, the low reimbursement rates.
Thank you. Representative Jordan and then Grunhagen.
Yes, thank you, Madam
Jordan.
I guess I have some questions about staffing levels at St. Peter. If we are not filling some of these positions or we're looking to, is that going to change the amount of patients at St. Peter? Are we looking to change any of our programming? And then, so if we're not filling these positions, and it's my understanding that they haven't been filled, how will that impact programming at St. Peter, just given some of the testimony from some of the employees there?
And that was for the commissioner, I assume, Representative Jordan?
Yeah.
Yeah. Commissioner?
Chair Liebling and Representative, we'll always be looking at making adjustments to be sure that we've got the right capacity to serve people well. And right now, we think we have generally the right capacity to serve people well, but hearing and knowing about some of the concerns about overtime, we might have to just make some adjustments going forward to be sure that we can handle the capacity at that hospital and do it well with the staff that we have. So this wouldn't be the last decision we would make. We'd be looking on a daily basis at how we were doing serving people and employing our staff. And so we'd have to continue to look at that and consider making additional adjustments to make it all work well.
Representative Jordan? Okay. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for the commissioner.
Please.
Okay. You know, one of the things we continually hear, not just on HHS, but on other areas, is that we have too many layers of management in government versus the frontline workers. What's your response to that? And then I have one quick follow-up.
Thank you. Commissioner.
Chair Liebling and Representative. That's an easy phrase to toss out there. There's no particular definition of how many people should be in management levels versus how many people should be on front lines in any organization. It's hard to know. I know that given the changes that we've made in DCT over the last few years and the levels of funding for it, that it's a fairly lean organization. And so I don't think it's got a disproportionately high number of management positions versus other health systems. In fact, Marshall Smith, who runs it, is able to look at data from the Minnesota Hospital Association and look at our health system in DCT compared to other health systems. And he's concerned on the other end that there aren't enough management positions. And this administrative reduction has him nervous about how he's going to accomplish that for the rest of this fiscal year. But we did take pretty significant reductions in administration, both in DCT and in DHS this week, in addition to some of the other changes that we have announced. So I think we've got that about right in this system, you know, but we could debate that all day long.
Representative Gernhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. And Commissioner, I was in I was 16 years on a school board. The majority of the time was spent in statutory operating debt. Okay. So I know this issue is not easy, but it's very necessary. And the sooner we take action, the less pain we'll have down the road, because everything tends to double down the road. But anyway, that's another point. Here's the, you know, just on the comparative data again, you know, again, I always have a certain level of skepticism, having served on the school board for 16 years. And what I found out is that the superintendent had access to data that school board members didn't at times. In other words, some superintendents, and I went through quite a few of them, selectively shared what they wanted to share with the elected members in order to promote their particular point, whatever it might be. So I would certainly appreciate a response to a request for comparative data on what you have and, you know, how much we have as committee members to be able to look at that. And then whether it's management numbers versus other states, and then to take your total budget and divide it by a population versus the populations of neighboring states, so that we could break down the cost on a per person basis. Again, there might be reasons why we have extra costs, and maybe they're good reasons. But as lay people, it helps us assess the questions we ask and to look into certain areas if they're excessive compared to other areas. I don't mean this to accuse in any way. I'm just trying to create a atmosphere of data that we can all work with and hopefully minimize the pain that's going to come out of this. So that's just a final comment. Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner and testifiers.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Gernhagen. I don't disagree with you. We need all the data we can get. And it occurs to me, though, I wonder if House research might be a place for us to get that. I mean, that is the kind of information that maybe House research could work in concert with DHS to try to pull something together on that if it isn't readily available, because also we have NCSL, the National Conference of State Legislatures, that has a lot of comparative data.
Yep.
So this should be something that shouldn't be, it can't be rocket science. I mean, it may be difficult to make, as I said before, and as others have said, to make apples to apples comparisons might be difficult. And I know you realize that as well, but it would be at least informative to have some general idea of what other states are doing that look like us in the way they're set up, even if they're not next door to us. So I agree that would be interesting to have.
Yep.
So I hope we can get some of that.
The sooner the better, because the debt only grows, that's for sure. So.
Well, that's right. And again, you know, we are a part-time legislature, and under normal conditions, we are not in session again until January. So I don't know what our actual ability to impact any of this is going to be. But I'm sure that DHS will be interested in our opinions about this, because definitely, at the very least, when we get back into session in January, this is going to be very much on our plates in that budget year. And, if this is the worst we have to deal with, then I think we should probably be grateful, because our challenge is going to be very big. Other questions or comments from members? We don't have to go the extra 15 minutes. We can end if folks are ready to do that.
closing comment?
Yeah, please, Commissioner, why don't you have the last word and then we'll finish.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. I just wanted to say, and I've said this to our employees, no one comes to the Department of Human Services to close vital services and lay off their colleagues. And it's been a very tough several weeks, really wrestling through this thing as we have. We ran scenarios where we would have closed more services and laid off more people, and we stopped ourselves at the scenario that you saw today. With the hope that there's a possibility of transitioning some of these services to community providers in a way that would maintain the services, the service capacity, maintain the jobs, and maintain these sites in local communities. And so not able to sort all that out fast enough, we made the decisions that we thought we needed to make as quickly as possible. And we want to continue looking at all of this and talking with you and with labor and with others to figure this all out. So we are pleased that we've come this far in reducing the deficit for this year, with an emphasis on maintaining jobs, maintaining sites in local communities, and maintaining overall capacity. Just for grins, we were playing around the other day with a bit of data and said, you know, if facing into the next biennium's enormous state budget deficit expectation, we were asked to cut, say, 5% from DHS, or just to take a look at that, that would be a cut of $831 million. And so I think you've said it well today that this is just the beginning of a very long and arduous conversation we will have together over the course of the next year to come to grips with the pandemic deficit that has happened in our state and across the nation and across the world. And so I appreciate the good questions that we've had here, and I appreciate the involvement and engagement of the members who are really trying to understand this and help us make these very, very difficult decisions. So thank you for your time today and your interest in what we're doing.
Okay, well, thank you, Commissioner. So of course, as usually happens, we have a couple of members that now that would like to ask questions. And I understand that Representative Hamilton wants to speak, and he wasn't able to raise his hand because he's on the phone, kind of like me, I'm on both. But Representative Hamilton, why don't you go ahead? You haven't had a chance. And then Representative Keel also had something she wanted to say further. Representative Hamilton? Might need to star six.
How's that?
Now we hear you.
All right. All right. Yep. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And what I was saying is I was driving. I pulled over now. So I'm safely on the side of the road here. But I'm very curious. Have any of the testifiers contacted the governor's office to not ask, but demand that he starts reopening the state's economy? It's absolutely essential that we are able to start collecting sales tax revenue, income tax revenue, so that we actually have the dollars needed to fund these much needed services. And the longer that the state remains closed, the worse that this is going to get. And what I said back in the springtime is talking about the science around COVID is great, but at some point in time, we need to be talking about the mathematics. And this should be a surprise to nobody. We've been bringing this way back up in, like I said, March, April, that we also have to be talking about the mathematics. And until we start getting these businesses back open and safely, because we can do it safely as well, but until we do that, the issue is only going to get worse. So my question is, are any of the testifiers contacting the governor to help us get this economy up and going again? And if not, why not? Thank you, Madam Chair.
So Representative Hamilton, I mean, I think that this is kind of pulling us off in another direction. And I would just say this, that every state is experiencing a problem. This is a nationwide problem. And we could argue here about the cause of the problem. I would say the problem with the economy is the pandemic, not what the governor has done to try to control the pandemic. And I would argue that the way to get our economy back is to focus on controlling the pandemic, which many states have not done under the banner of keep the economy open. But this is a nationwide problem. It's not a Minnesota-only problem. I've been talking to chairs of committees on seminars, people from across the country, and everyone is dealing with the same kind of issue. So this is not a matter of call the governor and tell him to open the economy. The economy is not open because of the pandemic, whether the governor has restrictions in place or not. So, you know, I don't want to pull us completely off into this. And I think we could just leave that issue there and for a debate for another time. We do have Representative Keel also who has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The reason I even raised my hand was because I knew that Representative Hamilton wanted to bring up this issue. But I will point out, I live in the western side of Minnesota, and I am watching much of the challenges that we have, they do not have, both in numbers of COVID and also in financial issues. And in fact, seriously, we are losing people to North Dakota because they're more capable of working and providing for their citizens. So I do think that it is affecting rural Minnesota and in many ways, but we won't go that far. So but I think we do have to get the economy open. We do have to get people, even though we're going to have to be concerned about some issues, we do need to get the economy moving, so that will help us to take care of the citizens we need to be. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keel. I don't think anyone debates that we need to get the economy going. That is broadly shared. The question is how? You know, that's the question that's really before us. And, you know, we just had a visit here from Dr. Birx from President Trump's Office of, the COVID Task Force. She was just here in Minnesota. And her message, she was here because, you know, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Iowa are now hotspots. They're growing with their COVID cases. So again, we're a little bit off track, but I just want to say that this is a nationwide issue. And we are not out of the woods, especially here in the Midwest. The COVID itself, the pandemic, is very concerning right now, right here in the Midwest. So, all right, I'm not seeing other questions. Commissioner, we appreciate your appearance here today. Thank you very much for coming and giving us all the explanation, answering questions. Thank you so much to the testifiers. We really appreciate hearing from you as well. Oh, and I should mention that although we don't have a testifier from the counties today, the counties did submit a letter that members should have. I want to congratulate the commissioner on her almost year in office, although sometimes you have to wonder whether it's condolences or congratulations, right? Because this is a very hard job, and now it's extremely hard. It's always easier for all of us when we have the difficult job of figuring out how to put more resources in to get the results we want. When we're in the position of having to make cuts, it's always extremely difficult and painful, and a very difficult time to be Commissioner of Human Services for sure. But thank you very much, members, for your attendance. You've asked excellent questions. I really appreciate your engagement. When we get additional information, we will share it with all of you. And, please, I hope you're getting some kind of a break and having some time off, but we're also going to need everybody's engagement as we go forward here, because we're going to have a lot of very difficult work to do to serve our constituents as very best we can in these difficult circumstances. So with that, seeing no other questions, we are adjourned.